6 o'clock in Barbados and the Eastern Caribbean, a day on which we remember many things that Mama said and in many cases continues to say to teach and instruct. As it relates to health, well, let's find out what's happening with Better Health. We've got Dr. Boyce and her special guest for today. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, Ronnie. Good evening to all of our listeners. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show, helping you to live your best life. I take this opportunity on behalf of the Better Health Radio Show to wish all those mothers and other persons who are celebrating Mother's Day today a happy and blessed Mother's Day. I hope that, and I do trust that you've had a wonderful day. For those of you who the day might have been a little sad because you might have lost your mother or grandmother or another close motherly figure, we offer you our condolences, but we trust that you can take the opportunity to reflect on those good times that you had with that special someone. Today on the Better Health Radio Show, we are going to be discussing the heart of COVID with Dr. Dawn Scantlebury. Dawn?
Hi, Rennie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Scantlebury before we jump into the heart, sorry, couldn't resist it, into the heart of our program.
Okay, yeah.
Dr. Scantlebury is a cardiologist at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, and she is a senior associate lecturer in cardiology at the University of the West Indies here at Cave Hill. She's a graduate of the class of 1998, and she completed her residency in internal medicine here in 2005. She left us for about a decade where she was doing several fellowships at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. But once she finished up those fellowships, she came right back home, and she started the percutaneous coronary intervention program. Percutaneous is through the skin, and we'll talk a little bit about that on this show today. She is the medical director of the Cardiac Rehabilitation Program at the Heart and Stroke Foundation. She's a member of its board of directors and a council member of the Caribbean Cardiac Society. And she's mainly interested in improving acute coronary syndrome management. And when we think of acute coronary syndromes, we're thinking things like angina and heart attacks and cardiac rehabilitation and the differences in sex and gender in cardiovascular disease. And Dr. Scantlebury is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and the American College of Cardiology. A wealth of knowledge in this one individual. Welcome again, Dr. Scantlebury.
Thank you. That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
It was, but it goes to show that, you know, here in Barbados, we have many, many talented and gifted individuals. And the Better Health Radio Show has showcased several of our local doctors who are highlighted people in their field. So congrats to you on all that you have managed to achieve.
Thank you.
Let us start with the basics. I believe in if you're building a house, you start with the foundation. When I was younger, I used to think that they started with the roof and
went down.
Yes, but we're going to start with the foundation. Tell us a little bit about the basics of the heart. How does it work? Why does it beat? What does it look like?
What does it look like? So, Renee, it is really interesting that you start with talking about foundations, because when I'm usually talking about the heart and trying to explain what it looks like, what it does, I actually use the house as my analogy. So if you think of your heart as a house, the heart house, just like your house has its walls, it has its doors and windows, it has its electrical wiring, it has its plumbing. The heart also has these structures. So the heart is like a bag of muscle. It has four separate chambers in it, or four separate rooms, if you want to carry the analogy a little bit further. On the right side, you have the right atrium. So, an atrium, if you go into an atrium of a building, that's the receiving chamber of that building, right? So just like that, the right atrium of the heart is the receiving chamber of the heart on the right side, where blood that has been processed in the body, you know, the oxygen and all the nutrients and all the good stuff has been taken out of it, are coming back to the heart via the veins. That atrium then sends blood through a valve to the right ventricle. So the ventricles are those pumping chambers. The muscle in the ventricles is a little bit thicker than in the atria, and it is able to squeeze blood out into the great vessels. So on the right side, the blood is squeezed out into the lungs, where the lungs processes this blood, puts oxygen in, takes carbon dioxide out, and other things come out of it as well. But, you know, specifically it's for gas exchange. And then once, you know, the good stuff is in there, the lungs send the blood back to the left atrium, another receiving chamber, but this time on the left side of the heart, and that sends blood through another valve through to the left ventricle. So the left ventricle is just about the most important chamber in the heart. It is the chamber that squeezes about 80 times per minute and sends blood out to the rest of your body. If your left ventricle fails, then you have heart failure, and if it stops working, then you die. Obviously, the rest of the heart stops working as well, but it's critically important that your left ventricle has a good blood supply and works very well. So those four chambers, the two atria and the two ventricles, and then you have those doors within the heart, those are the valves. The chambers, the walls of the chambers are made up of muscle. And then in order for the heart to do what it needs to in a concerted manner, it has to have electrical wiring to each of those chambers to tell the heart to beat. So that's the conduction system of the heart. And it is truly electricity that is going through your heart in minuscule amounts. And then for the heart to do what it needs to do and to work, it has to have its own plumbing, its own blood supply to take oxygen to the muscle of the heart, to the right ventricle, to the left ventricle, etc. So that plumbing is the arteries, the coronary arteries, which are the arteries that you would hear about involved in heart attacks. And then the heart, of course, has its own veins as well. So again, it's just like a house, you know, with all the different things that make up a house. And unfortunately, just like, you know, your plumbing can go bad in your house, or your electrical wiring can get a short circuit in the house, that things can go wrong in the heart as well.
So we have this structure that's vitally important to our existence. You said if the left ventricle really doesn't pump as it should, or if for whatever reason it's not working, then we end up getting heart failure. And let's talk a little bit about some of the signs of heart failure, because sometimes patients don't understand the symptoms that they might be having as actual symptoms of heart failure, and hence don't seek medical attention as quickly as they should.
Okay, sure. So taking our analogy another step, heart failure is a syndrome whereby the heart does not work well enough to supply the tissues of your body. So that left ventricle, as it tries to squeeze, isn't squeezing out enough blood to have your body work appropriately. Or if it can squeeze out enough blood, it has to it's sick enough that the pressure inside the heart has to build up in order to get enough blood out. So what ends up happening is that either you have backward pressure, where fluid builds up in the lungs and you get fluid in the lungs, or you have forward problems where it's a pump problem, the heart isn't squeezing out enough, and the person feels fatigued, lightheaded, weak, etc. So heart failure comes as a result of damage to those walls, either because of a heart attack or because of a viral infection that attacks the heart, or because of high blood pressure, or, you know, there are a myriad of things that can cause problem with the heart walls. And then, you know, because of either that forward flow problem or the back flow problem, patients can experience shortness of breath on exertion, shortness of breath at rest if more severe. Common complaint is shortness of breath lying down at night, because, you know, when you're lying down, you get more blood supply back from the legs, etc., and it goes into the heart, and that pressure goes up. So patients have to sleep propped up, or sometimes in the middle of the night, they wake up feeling like they can't catch the breath. And, you know, they sit on the side of the bed or have to go to the window to open the window to get that breath. Swelling in the legs is another common symptom of heart failure. And then, as I said, weakness and fatigue.
One of the things that I've discovered over the years about medicine is that there are many causes for similar symptoms. So, yes. For example, heart failure can cause swelling of the legs. But if you have, let's say, venous insufficiency, where you have varicose veins and your feet swell, as a result of that, you can get leg swelling. So there are times when you might have one condition, or you might have, let's say you have heart failure, but a neighbor says to you, oh, that's just varicose veins, or that's just something else, when there could be something seriously wrong with you. So I think one of the things that we really do want to get across on this show is that whatever symptoms you're having, that's why your doctor is there for you to discuss these symptoms so that we catch these things early rather than later, because it's usually more difficult to treat heart failure in the end stages than it is to treat it earlier. So let's talk a little bit about the blood supply to the heart, not necessarily the anatomy of, because I'm allergic to anatomy, but the fact that the heart has its own blood supply, and many patients are surprised that the heart actually has its own blood supply.
Exactly. So the heart takes care of itself first, huh? So, you know, when the left ventricle squeezes and sends the blood out the aortic valve into the aorta, that's the main blood vessel that comes off of the heart. The very, very first branch that comes off just after that blood is ejected from the heart, first branches are the coronary arteries, and they wrap back to supply the muscle of the heart. They run along the outside, and then they branch and send progressively get smaller as they send blood vessels into the tissue and the muscle of the heart. So things that can go wrong with the blood vessels, the same thing that can go wrong with blood vessels all over the body. Talking to the general public, if you've ever heard of hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis is what that term means. Atherosclerosis means hardening of these blood vessels. That comes as a result of cholesterol plaque being laid down into the blood vessel. And that process starts very early. In fact, autopsy studies in the Korean War, where they looked at the blood vessels of young soldiers, had the initial lesion that is present in the blood vessels that's a precursor to atherosclerosis. So atherosclerosis is one of these diseases that comes with age, but there are things out there that we can do to slow down its progression. So high blood pressure can cause damage to the lining of the blood vessel, and that can speed up atherosclerosis. Diabetes can also lead to a speeding up of atherosclerosis or cholesterol plaque being laid down. Obviously, if it's cholesterol plaque being laid down into the blood vessel and you have excess cholesterol floating through your blood, then that can do it as well. A family history is another major risk factor, and smoking. So those are the top five risk factors for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or cholesterol plaque in the blood vessels. And so when you get this cholesterol plaque being laid down in the blood vessels of the heart, if it builds up past a certain point, you can get a decrease in the blood supply going to the muscle of the heart. So what patients can experience is chest discomfort, or again, shortness of breath on exertion. So they're going up a flight of stairs and they're feeling a little bit of pressure on the chest, or tightness, or squeezing, or sticking, or, you know, there's so many different ways that people describe that symptom. Sometimes people don't get pain at all. They just get shortness of breath. Sometimes people just get a bit of an aching in the shoulder, either shoulder or the jaw. But the key there is that it's on exertion. As time goes by and that lesion and that blockage becomes progressively worse and that plumbing becomes more and more blocked up, the level of exertion that someone has to do in order to get these symptoms becomes less. So before they would have to walk a mile before they got chest pain or walk up a hill before they got chest pain. But now they just get chest pain or whatever symptom is their anginal equivalent, just walking across the room. Now, that's quite severe angina. Angina is the symptom I'm talking about, chest pain related to a blocked blood vessel. And obviously, you know, if you are getting symptoms just walking across the room, that is something that requires urgent attention. And all of this that I'm describing is a symptom, and it's something to worry about, yes, but this is stable angina. It comes with exertion, goes away with rest. Unstable angina, on the other hand, and other acute coronary syndromes are symptoms that come at rest. So you've been accustomed to getting this chest pain for the last 5 years on exertion. It was predictable. You learned to live with it. You were ignoring it. And then all of a sudden, last night, it woke you up in the middle of the night. You weren't walking across the room. You may have had a bad dream, but you know, you weren't doing anything, and it woke you up, and it went away. You went and drank some ginger tea. And then, you know, in the morning, you got up, and you're trying to do stuff, and you realize that the pain is a lot worse than it was, and then it comes on and stays. That is an unstable symptom and requires urgent attention. In fact, it requires a call to 511 so that you can get to the hospital immediately.
Dawn, do you know, or can you imagine the number of people in Barbados that have died from gas?
That have died from gas. You are right. Because they wake up with that pain in the night, and they say, oh, it's just gas. Let me just drink some ginger tea. And before you know it, somebody finds them in their bed.
Yes, or in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
That's another common place that persons who might have had a heart attack or so are found.
Exactly.
So again, we want to get it across to persons that if you find that you are having chest pain is one of those symptoms that you really can't miss. You can't miss that you're having chest pain. There are many causes for chest pain, all the way from bone pain, muscle pain, there's lungs in there, there's the heart in there, so many causes. And there can also be what we call referred pain, so pain from one site being felt somewhere else. But what we want you, the listening public, to understand is call your doctor. And if the pain is severe or if it wasn't there before, and what are some of the other symptoms, Dawn, that you can get going along with the unstable angina or a heart attack?
Or a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes this pain is associated with profuse sweating. Sometimes shortness of breath again. Sometimes nausea. And it's interesting that you mention people being found in the bathroom. Sometimes that there's nausea and vomiting and a feeling of being sick to the stomach or feel that they need to go to the bathroom to evacuate. All of those can go along with the chest pain. There are some patients who never get chest pain at all. For instance, diabetics, because they have nerve problems and the nerves that create pain are damaged, so they don't feel that pain. But a lot of those other symptoms are there, so they feel sick to the stomach. They just feel bad. There's this sudden onset of feeling bad and profuse sweating that came on them for no good reason. Sometimes those come along without the pain. Another interesting symptom is the feeling of impending doom. So the patient feels as though there's something wrong. They feel like they're going to die. They don't quite know what is going on. And that itself is something that should make us sit up and listen. You know, this patient is saying, I'm having a heart attack, even though they're not saying, in the words, I'm having a heart attack. But when they're feeling so bad, it's something that we really pay attention to.
And we spoke about diabetics not presenting. And in medicine, when we talk about presenting, it means going to a doctor or to somewhere to get medical care. Diabetics don't have the typical symptoms of that, you know, central crushing chest pain. And sometimes neither do women.
And sometimes neither do women. True.
Yes, women and the elderly.
Correct. So the thing is, there's, you know, this wide spectrum of symptoms. Diabetics, yes, can get chest pain. They can get the very classic symptoms. But again, because they have these nerve problems, they may not get the chest pain at all. In fact, they may just feel this funny feeling. And sometimes we get people coming in with heart failure. And when you do the testing, they have had a heart attack. And now they're presenting with the symptoms of their heart muscle being damaged. And then when you go back into the history, and you really, really take a very, very careful history, there was something that happened one night that they just brushed it off, and that was their heart attack. And then women, there is this set of symptoms that women can get, that men can also get, but women more commonly get them, so like the shortness of breath or referred pains or pain in the jaw, etc. Men often get a lot of sweating, but women tend more to get the nausea and the shortness of breath. But again, women more commonly will get chest pain than not. So if they get chest pain, they shouldn't brush it off and say, women are accustomed to getting chest pain with a heart attack, so it must be something else. I mean, just house gas. It may just be that you're getting a heart attack and you need to go to the doctor. Go to the emergency room.
All right. One of the things that we had read in your bio, Dawn, was your interest in the differences in sex and gender in cardiovascular disease. What sorts of information have you discovered about the differences between men and women with respect to cardiovascular disease?
So there are differences in terms of, like we were discussing, in terms of disease presentation symptoms, differences in terms of timing of presentation. So, for instance, men tend to develop cardiovascular disease at an earlier age, a full 10 years earlier than women will. So whereas we say premature cardiovascular disease for a man is between 45 and 55, is between, or I should say under the age of 55, under the age of 65 is premature cardiovascular disease in a woman. And that's because the hormones like estrogen specifically is protective of the cardiovascular system in women. After 65, though, or after menopause, I should say, as you lose that estrogen, the women rapidly catch up and cardiovascular disease or more atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease develops. The disease profile is also slightly different. So take a subset of 70-year-old men and 70-year-old women. More men will have coronary disease. They will have more heart attacks. They will have more angina, angina that when you'd look at the coronary arteries, you could see something. Women would have more small vessel disease. So those really, really tiny vessels inside the muscle that we can't see, women tend to have those blocked up a little bit easier than men do, and it's because their blood vessels are smaller, and has something to do with hormones as well. Women will have more heart failure, and their heart failure will tend to be more related to stiffness of the heart muscle rather than weakness of the heart muscle. And some of the reason why that happens is, again, because of those small vessels. And then at the time of presentation with heart attack symptoms, so somebody comes in with severe chest pain, chances are, if it's a man, it's going to be a typical heart attack. But if it's a woman, there are different conditions that you're not accustomed to seeing in women. So there's in men. So there is a condition called broken heart syndrome, which is the layman's term for it. The fancy name for it is Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. Yes, I know.
Yeah, we'll go with broken heart.
let's go with broken heart syndrome. Or stress-induced cardiomyopathy. So cardiomyopathy, cardio meaning heart, myo meaning muscle, and pathy meaning disease. So heart muscle disease is what cardiomyopathy means. And this stress-induced cardiomyopathy or broken heart syndrome occurs in women over a stressful situation. And it could be good stress too, mind you, but it's still a stressful situation. So,
the old people weren't wrong when they were saying that somebody died of a broken heart.
They weren't wrong.
They just didn't know, the correct term for it.
Exactly. So, one of the things that we think is one of the symptoms of this is the old person who has lived with their spouse for the last 60, 70 years, and that spouse dies, and very, very soon after that, the person dies.
So,
then we think that is maybe due to broken heart syndrome. There is another condition that occurs in women immediately after pregnancy, peripartum cardiomyopathy. It's relatively rare, more common in the black population, but still something to be concerned about. So if you have those heart failure symptoms that we described earlier with swelling of the legs and shortness of breath on exertion, shortness of breath line of that, especially after delivery, when all of that swelling from pregnancy should have gone away, that's something to go back to your doctor for.
I remember once being on call in an accident and emergency. Can't remember which team I was on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a gentleman who came in, and he was heaving. I can see him in front of me now. He was heaving, and we were looking at the monitor. We were looking at the different changes that were going on with his heart and so on. And you came in,
mm-hmm.
and we were discussing at that point in time how severe the heart attack was and what the chances were of his survival. So what are some of the tools or some of the things that doctors would look at to determine how severe a heart attack is? I mean, granted, any heart attack is a severe thing, nothing that should be mm-hmm. trifled with at all. But why is it that some people recover from a heart attack while others don't?
So a heart attack, as I said, it occurs when you get a blocked blood vessel that supplies the muscle of the heart. And obviously, it depends on the size of the blood vessel. It depends on how high up in the blood vessel it is. So if you have, let's say, take for instance a tree. If you chop down a tree at its roots, that tree is gone. If you chop down the trunk way up on the tree, just the top part of the tree goes away, and then you still have the rest of the tree. Just think of it that way. So if you block off a blood vessel at its where it comes off the aorta, at the its main, just as it starts to supply the heart, you lose a lot more heart muscle than if it occurs further down in the blood vessel. It also depends on the specific vessel that's involved. So there are three coronary arteries. If one gets blocked off, say it's the circumflex, that's not important, but it's it's a relatively small circumflex, and the LAD and the right coronary artery are still open. You lose a lot less heart muscle, and the chances are a lot better. So an LAD territory heart attack. So that's the LAD is the blood vessel, the main blood vessel that goes down in front of the heart. Those heart attacks tend to have a lot more muscle disease going along with it. That said, any heart attack can cause significant amount of damage depending on the size of the vessel we're talking about. So when patients come in with a heart attack, the first thing that's done, aside from taking a quick history and physical exam, is to do an ECG, and that gives us an idea as to whether it's what type of heart attack it is and how we are going to treat at that point. And then there are different things that we do. We do blood tests, and we are looking for biomarkers or markers coming from damaged heart muscle. And the higher the biomarker, the worse the damage. We do ultrasounds of the heart. That's an echocardiogram. And the worse the damage, the the worse the prognosis. At the time of presentation, though, like you were discussing, someone coming in and, like you say, they're heaving and they're short of breath and they're in heart failure, that tends to be a really severe presentation. And especially if you link the heart failure to a hemodynamic compromise, meaning your blood pressure is low and you may have abnormal rhythms. All of those things suggest that this person's prognosis is worse.
One of the things that I distinctly remember from that night was you saying to me, you know, having a heart attack is a very painful process. And it never, not that it never really dawned on me, but no, at that particular point in time, watching that gentleman and he was in great distress.
Yeah.
You can understand or you can feel a little bit the pain that he might have been going through. So really yeah. shouldn't trifle with chest pain at all. Really shouldn't.
Right. Yep. That said, it's interesting, and I've noticed this, men often get more pain than women. So say, you know, that the man will come in, they'll get this severe, severe pain. And that's one of the reasons why they actually present to a hospital earlier than the woman will. So the woman might get more shortness of breath or feel bad, and they'll stay at home. And unfortunately, you know, the longer you stay at home, the more damage is done to the heart muscle. Whereas the man who gets the severe chest pain, they're like, I'm getting a heart attack. I need to get rid of this pain. Now I'm getting to the hospital. And that is often what saves their life. I have this patient, he did very, very well. So he's been discharged back to primary care. But he was in town one day, and he had this severe chest pain. He felt so bad. He called a taxi driver and got him to the hospital within, I think, 10 to 15 minutes of onset of symptoms. And as soon as he got into the emergency room, his heart stopped.
Wow.
You know, so this is within half an hour of onset of symptoms. Imagine if his symptoms, that chest pain, was not as severe. He may have taken his time to try and see how he could get to the hospital or even walk up the road from town. Mm-hmm. And he may have fallen down dead in the street. But because he got to a hospital, his heart stopped. He was able to be shocked into a normal rhythm immediately because the doctor was there. He got the medication to dissolve the clot that was in the blood vessel. And he did extremely, extremely well. Minimal damage. So the key is to get to hospital as soon as those symptoms start. Because the longer you wait, the more muscle is damaged. We say time is muscle in this. Time is muscle. So the more time, more muscle is damaged. The less time, the less muscle is damaged.
Let's talk just a little bit. You mentioned it there just now. So let's talk a little bit about what can be done if you get to the hospital early enough with a heart attack. In terms of treatment.
Right. So I'll go back to what I was saying about what a heart attack actually is. So you have that cholesterol plaque in the blood vessel. So that cholesterol plaque can be stable or unstable. And, you know, there's this lining overlying it. Sometimes that the lining degrades and it can rupture. And if the plaque ruptures, a clot forms within the blood vessel. A clot is an acute process. As soon as that thing ruptures, the body tries to heal it over, and that clot can be large enough to completely block off the blood vessel. So the treatment for a heart attack is to dissolve the clot. Depending on the type of heart attack it is, we give blood thinners to allow the body to get rid of the clot on its own if it's not an occlusive clot. But if it's a clot that's causing the blood vessel to be completely blocked off, and there are signs on ECG that can help us differentiate the two, we have to give a medication that dissolves that clot. Unfortunately, the medications that we give can dissolve clots otherwise. So when we are discussing this with patients, we have to make sure that they don't have a risk factor for bleeding and so bleeding into the brain, etc. The risk of that is very, very low, but you just have to make sure that they don't have those particular conditions that can put them at risk for that. Once we give that medication, it's called a thrombolytic agent. We also give blood thinners to, or I should say anticoagulants, to prevent that clot from coming back, the clot that we just dissolved, to prevent it from coming back. We also give medication to slow the heart rate and to decrease the workload on the heart. So aspirin is a key feature of our medication profile. And cholesterol medication, again, to stabilize that plaque, because that plaque was unstable. So the statins work very well to help stabilize the plaque. There are other medications that we do to offload the heart and to prevent heart failure from the scar on the heart. But at the initial presentation, the key is to get rid of clot.
One of the things that you do as well would be the percutaneous
coronary intervention.
Yes. Coronary intervention. So let's break that down.
Yes. So percutaneous coronary intervention. Percutaneous means through the skin. It's an invasive procedure, but we're not opening up the chest wall like the surgeons do. Coronary, we've discussed what the coronaries are, and intervention is to actually perform a procedure to intervene into the process of this disease, so to treat. Whereas we can do procedures where we just diagnose, and intervention is a treatment. In the U.S. and sometimes in Barbados as well, but it's a very labor-intensive and staff-intensive procedure, and we're not at the point of doing it yet. But in the setting of an acute heart attack, what happens in larger centers in the U.S., when someone comes in with a heart attack, as opposed to giving that thrombolytic agent, what they do is wheel that patient up to the cardiac catheterization laboratory immediately and set about opening up the blood vessel through angioplasty and stenting. Angioplasty is where you put a little tiny balloon into the blood vessel, dilate it up to kind of create space for blood flow to go through. And a stent is like a little mesh metal tube that goes into the blood vessel and crimp down over the balloon. And when we dilate the balloon, and the stent opens up and keeps the blood vessel open.
Right, mm-hmm. So that you can get that blood flow going
to the heart muscle. Okay. So percutaneous coronary intervention, and I will just use the term angioplasty because it's less of a mouthful. Angioplasty has become standard of care for heart attacks worldwide in settings where it can be done in a timely manner. So if your system is not set up to do this in a very, very urgent manner, thrombolytics are still standard of care. And then there is the situation where we combine the two. We give the thrombolytic agent or the clot-busting agent, and then within 3 to 24 hours after, the patient comes to the cardiac cath lab in a more controlled setting, and you look at the blood vessel and perform angioplasty as necessary.
Okay, and certainly there are risks that are associated with this and any other procedure.
And any other procedure that we do.
So patients will know they would have to sign a consent form and these different things to make sure that they've understood the risk.
Actually, I will tell you, in a lot of, similar to a lot of other emergency procedures that are done, there are some centers in the U.S. where a consent form is not signed.
Okay.
Because everything, there's just this mad rush up to the cath lab. There's verbal consent.
Okay.
Because the process of going through a written consent actually takes a lot of time. That is killing heart muscle. And because it's deemed an emergency procedure, just like thrombolytics and given drugs, you come into a hospital to give IV fluids and to put up an IV line, et cetera. All of these things have risks, and you don't actually sign consent for them.
That's true.
So because you're doing emergency procedures, and to stop and sign consent is going to increase your likelihood of a bad outcome. So there are a lot of places where a signed consent form is not done. When you come in the door and you give consent at the entry to the emergency room for treatment for this emergency, that tends to be a blanket consent. So it depends on what the laws are in the setting that you're in. So, but, you know, verbal consent versus written consent are it's pretty much the same thing. It's just they're signing a consent form where it's with the written consent. There's a lot of legalities about that that I wouldn't get into at this point, but it is an emergency procedure.
Yeah, so it's about saving a life.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. So our topic today is getting to the heart of COVID.
Yes.
So from the beginning, we were discussing the structure of the heart, where we looked at the heart like a house and different walls and the different rooms and the purposes of the blood vessels and the different chambers in the heart, and the fact that the heart runs on an electrical system, which is why we can do ECGs that look at the rhythm of the heart and can give us information about what's going on with the heart. And you mentioned the ultrasound of the heart, the echo, mm-hmm. that you can get that can also give you a better picture of what goes on with the heart, the valves, and so on. In recent times, we've heard that there are newer symptoms being associated with the coronavirus infection. Previously, it would have been sore throat, a fever, the typical flu-like symptoms,
right,
and a dry cough. And then a couple of weeks ago, persons, I think it started in France and Germany, where they recognized that persons were coming in with difficulty smelling and tasting. And now persons are discovering that coronavirus is having an effect or effect on the heart.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
So actually from China, the Chinese, obviously coronavirus was first recognized in China, and they have a huge body of literature that they've put out based on their initial experience. And after they had, you know, their emergency was over, and they put together all of their experience, one of the things that they were discovering, or they did discover, was that there were particularly type of heart attacks that they were seeing in patients with coronavirus. So remember we discussed the thrombolytic agents and primary angioplasty for heart attacks. So they found that some of their patients with coronavirus presented very, very similarly to a typical heart attack, so the same chest pain, etc. But when they took these patients to the cardiac cath lab, their blood vessels were normal. But they still had weakness of the heart muscle that one would expect that you would see with a heart attack. And the presumption is that it's those little small vessels that had little microthrombi or microclots that caused the heart attack. Another presumption is that it may have been a myocarditis, so an inflammation of the heart muscle directly from the coronavirus itself. Also, there, you know, you can get electrical or arrhythmias as a result of viral illnesses. So coronavirus is also one of the illnesses that can cause it. You know, so myocarditis, that's the heart muscle disease, pericarditis, where you get inflammation of the lining of the heart, heart attack type symptoms, and of course heart failure. Those are different things that can occur with coronavirus. Some of these patients had symptoms, classic symptoms of the virus, so fever and shortness of breath, etc., but some of them did not. Also, in the setting of severe coronavirus or COVID disease, where there's this severe pneumonia-like illness and heart and respiratory failure, heart failure can be associated with that. So patients who are very ill on a ventilator and in septic shock can also have cardiac involvement as well.
So there are many, many causes, both directly and indirectly, for the heart being involved in the COVID-19 infection. One of the things that we had discussed even before thinking about this show was the fact that the notices that were going out had emphasized about not going to the hospital if you had particular symptoms.
Right.
So on and so forth. And there was a probability or possibility that persons who had other conditions were just hearing half of the message, which
exactly.
said, don't go to the hospital.
Exactly.
And patients were staying at home. So patients were
exactly.
having heart attacks and
yeah.
and staying at home because in their minds they were hearing,
don't go to know, hospital.
Don't go to the hospital. Don't go to the hospital.
Exactly.
So let's clarify.
Let's clarify that very, very important point. So at the beginning of this whole process, you know, when, you know, we got our first cases and we started cutting down on elective admissions, elective procedures, et cetera, and emptying out the wards, as it were, we kind of, you know, expected that our admission rate for usual stuff, heart failure, heart attacks, et cetera, would remain, but it didn't. And as I, you know, reached out on my social media platforms, etc., I realized that there were people all over the world seeing exactly the same thing. There was this, you know, really significant decline in admission rate for heart attacks. The people from the north of Italy, the Lombardy region, were wondering, where are the heart attacks? Unfortunately, and all over the U.S. as well, it was universal all over the world. Everybody was wondering, where are the heart attacks? Where is the heart failure? Where are these patients? And unfortunately, as time has gone by and people can't put up with symptoms anymore, et cetera, what people have realized is that there is this rebound in the admission rate for all of these cardiovascular illnesses. And some of it is, you know, is multifactorial. Some of it is because people have stayed at home. They got the message that the polyclinics were closed, but didn't get the message that the polyclinics were giving prescriptions. They got the message that they shouldn't go to the doctor with symptoms, with shortness of breath, but didn't link that shortness of breath they had with their usual heart failure.
Or other possible causes.
Or other possible symptoms. So there has been this progression of these chronic illnesses that are now making patients all over the world present with more severe disease. And unfortunately, you know, there's this, you know, catch-up effect and probably more than a catch-up effect where the wards are starting to fill up very quickly and bulge at the seams with these chronic conditions. And it's not just in Barbados, it's all over the world. So we still, you know, we have to have some measure of common sense and a sensible approach to the whole thing. Yes, there's a curfew. Yes, you shouldn't be on the road gallivanting after a certain time. But if you have a particular reason to get on the road and go to hospital because you're having symptoms, you are fully within your rights to do so.
Right.
You, in fact, please do it. And you know, I'm pretty sure the government of Barbados does not want you to stay at home getting your heart attack, because we have a public health system, and when you stay at home with your heart attack, you are going to cost everybody a lot more money
exactly.
when we try to treat your heart failure later on.
And one of
but
the
it's
other
not
things,
just that. Sorry?
One of the other things would be, you know, to plead with the public as well not to use symptoms as an excuse for being out on the road.
On
because
the road.
There are those persons who, if they were stopped, were going to claim that they were ill. You know, we're just asking persons to be reasonable, to be honest,
yeah,
and
exactly.
want to stay when you're supposed to be off the road, be off the road. Don't pretend to have symptoms and so on when you truly don't.
When you truly don't, exactly. So something else that I want to raise about this whole chronic condition
mm-hmm.
thing, and I know, you know, I think we've all gotten the message, patients who have chronic conditions are more at risk of severe COVID disease. So, and it's especially so if those chronic conditions are poorly controlled.
Are not controlled.
So the message there is to control your conditions, right? It is, if you have diabetes and you're supposed to be taking a specific medication, take the medication. Do not allow yourself to run out of it. And it's not just about medication. It's also about sensible eating. It's also about exercising, and I really, really welcome the relaxation of the rules as far as people being able to get out there and exercise. Unfortunately, I have to say, because I'm somebody who goes out on the road early in the morning, I have not really seen a huge increase in the numbers of people being on the road and working on those chronic conditions. So I encourage the Barbadian public to get out there and get active and control their diabetes and hypertension through physical activity. Because that, aside from their decreasing your risk of cardiovascular disease later on, it also decreases your risk of severe COVID disease if you're unlucky enough to contract the coronavirus.
Dawn, if I can interject here, I remember hearing some complaints for some older patients and some people who generally used to get up in the morning that they didn't feel safe on the roads at times. That was one. And two, because depending on the time of the year, how dark it would have been at certain times. So for those persons who don't want to leave their home to exercise, there are thousands of videos on the different social media platforms that you can use. And they're free. There are so many of them that are free. Many persons that would have previously had videos and exercise programs that had a cost attached to them because of the quarantine and so on, they've taken off their cost and so on. And even before then, there were many, many that were free. So there's the option of, we were talking about social distancing. Perhaps you can use one of the social media platforms, link up with a friend, and exercise.
And exercise.
To one of the videos at home. You know, don't use this as an excuse to not try to get those chronic diseases under control.
Exactly. And aside from exercise on the roads and et cetera. Well, let me just back up. I know people are concerned about going out alone, but you can exercise with up to three people if they're not from your household.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't use the fear of going outside alone to stop you. You know, link up with a buddy, call somebody, your next door neighbor, etc. Make it a community thing. Just get active, though. And it's not just, you know, workout videos. We have lots of good music in Barbados, good soca, calypso,
local music.
And just putting on your favorite radio station and your favorite DJ and dancing around the house for 10 minutes at a time, or even half an hour if you're so inclined and building up a sweat. That can really burn some calories. So,
lots of people had asked about gardening.
Well, it depends on how you're gardening.
if you're just putting around in some flower pots, well, maybe
exactly.
Not, but some serious forking and
serious forking and hoeing, you know, that can really build up sweat.
Yeah, so the aim is to get that heart rate up and to break a sweat.
Yep.
All right, so let us take this opportunity to select those points that you really want persons to understand from.
Okay.
Oh, and one of the things that we should talk about even before we get ready to go is prevention.
Well, I was going to start with that.
Okay, well, Dawn, take it away.
So remember I talked about the five top reasons, the five top risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, family history, and smoking. Can't do anything about your family history, but you certainly can do something about those numbers, about knowing your blood pressure numbers, see your doctor, and get your blood pressure under control through diet, exercise, and appropriate medication. Same thing with diabetes, same thing with cholesterol. If you smoke, stop. Yeah, full stop. Don't start. Don't continue. Don't contemplate it. Just stop. Work with your doctor if you're truly and severely addicted to come up with methods of stopping. And then there are other things that you can do to try to prevent these chronic conditions and help control chronic conditions. So get active, eat better, eat more plants, don't eat too much food. and maintain a healthy weight. So if you think about those things that I just said, they actually add up to 7 things. And that's Life Simple 7, which is a term coined from the American Heart Association.
Say it again.
Life's Simple 7. And I will go through them again.
Sure.
Eat well. And I usually say, if you're going to be eating well, you're eating mostly plants, not too much, and eat real food, things straight from the earth. Get active, move more, you know, dance around the house, walk on the road, whatever, the things that we were just discussing. Maintain a healthy weight. That's number 3. Mm-hmm. Don't smoke. Control your diabetes. Control or your blood sugar if you're not diabetic yet. Control your blood pressure and control your cholesterol. Those are Life Simple 7.
Okay, I love that. I really love that.
Right.
Oh, and we can talk about the plate size, yeah, as well, because that's something people are at home now. They're eating themselves out of house and land.
And home. Oh, my goodness. I should say, put a chain around the fridge.
Yes. Yeah.
Step away from the refrigerator. So plate size. What do you usually tell your patients?
Well, my plate from the USA, myplate.gov, mm-hmm, would just be to generally divide the plate in half, and that, mm-hmm, half should be vegetables. Mm-hmm. Either salads or steamed vegetables, raw vegetables,
mm-hmm,
properly washed.
Right.
And then divide the other half into quarters, and one quarter for your carbohydrates, which would be preferably the slow-burning carbohydrates, so sweet potatoes as opposed to English potatoes and,
right,
yams and those things. And again, people have to remember that not because it's healthy that you can overeat, because they still add calories, and it will still end up being stored as fat if it's not used up.
Yep.
So you can still overeat on healthy food. So portion, mm-hmm, size is the important thing. And the other quarter would be your protein. So lean,
exactly,
meat and the fish. Food preparation method. Try not to fry. Bake instead of frying. And you can boil, you can steam, blend, all those other things. But really try not to immerse your food in oils and then the salad dressings, which are creamy and full of oil. So those are some tips.
Right. So that, you know, quarter out the food. And, you know, interesting that you say cut it in half. So sometimes what I tell patients is, if you don't want to eat a big salad, you can cut the vegetable portion in half as well. So you have truly quarters. One quarter is for your cooked vegetable, and the other quarter is for your salad, and then the other two for protein. Like fish. And it doesn't have to be fish or meat. It could be beans or lentils, etc. And the other quarter for carbohydrates, so grains, whole grains, ground provisions, whatever.
And the important thing is put things on the plate that you like. It's official. I do not like green lettuce. I cannot. I'm unable. I have tried. So it doesn't make any sense.
So why put green lettuce on your plate?
Exactly. And then you're going to get so discouraged, you know, and I'm not, mm-hmm, eating healthily. And
exactly.
No, you put things on the plate that you like. There must be something out there that's healthy that you like. So you just,
exactly,
look around for options. And again, the internet, so many different options for recipes, mm-hmm, and healthy recipes.
Yep.
So let me ask you, Dawn, that one point that you want individuals to remember from this conversation that we've been having this evening, what is it?
Don't ignore your symptoms. Do not ignore your symptoms. If you're having sudden onset chest pain, shortness of breath, you're getting up and that pain is getting worse, or the shortness of breath is getting worse, please seek medical attention. We of course, are in the time of COVID, and we want you to stay off the road. But if you have any symptom that outside of the time of COVID would have prompted you to seek medical attention, let it prompt you to seek medical attention now, because ultimately, things are going to be so much worse for everyone, especially you, if you ignore those symptoms.
Yes, that is so true. Dawn, we really wish to say thanks to you for taking the time out to educate us on the basic cardiology, basic heart matters, and the changes that occur in the heart with respect to the COVID-19 infection. Continue to stay safe, you and your family. And we look forward to having you on the show again a little later down in the year.
Thank you. Good night, Nini.
Yes, you
and
are most welcome.
To the whole of Barbados. Stay safe.
Yes.
Get active.
Agreed. We want you to get active. I think that should be our focus this year. You know, get active in the middle of COVID. Ah, right. Maybe that should be our slogan.
Yeah, exactly. Get active in the middle of COVID. Like that.
I am going to copyright it.
All right.
Thanks again, Ronnie.
Yes, indeed. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And here's praying that you have a wonderful evening as well.
Yes, thank you very much. And have a good evening.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Whenever I was down, you were always there to comfort me. And no one else can be what you have been.